Good evening, folks. Franz Weinschenk here, welcoming you to another edition of Valley Writers Read, where our own Valley writers get a chance to read their stories to all of us. Tonight, two stories. First, a story by Bakersfield author Jack Hernandez entitled Called, and then a story by Oscar G. Williams entitled Scamming. So let's get started by listening to that first story from the pen of Jack Hernandez. He entitles it Called. Here is David Otero to read Called.
Well, I'm looking for the silver lining. Silver lining in the clouds. Yet I'm searching for, yet I'm searching for no philosopher's stone. If you hear that engine, why can you hear that engine drone? Well, I'm on the road again and I'm searching for, searching for the philosopher's stone.
Called. Over the Tehachapi Mountains, down into the San Joaquin Valley and along Edison Highway, I came to Bakersfield and its community college. That was 1961. That was the end of one journey and the beginning of another still continuing. That was also the road the Jodes in Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath took, with apprehension and exhilaration over a new beginning. As Tom Jode said as they descended into the Great Valley, Jesus, are we going to start clean? We sure ain't bringing nothing with us. My feelings exactly. I had traveled a long way from home with all my young life's belongings. Some useless horse blanket thick wool sport coats, sweaters and boxes of books loaded into a station wagon I was to deliver to an L.A. car dealer. I had left family, friends, and an exciting college town, Ann Arbor, with its intellectual and cultural ferment and liberal politics. I had left behind the landscape of boyhood, its tangy, leaf-colored autumns, bracing, sometimes icy, sometimes soft, white-flaked and snow-drifted winters, its rejuvenating, warm, rain-breezed, green-scented springs, and its lush, canopy-leafed thunder and lightning summers. I had left all this to come to Bakersfield. As I drove down Edison Highway, my spirits sank some. The landscape was dry and dusty, the buildings old and somewhat run down, and the air was brown and wavy with heat. It was August. It was hot. Very hot. Welcome to summer in Bakersfield. Needing directions, I stopped and was sent to East Bakersfield. My spirits bottomed out. Some downtown, I thought. A real downtown for me was Detroit's or Chicago's. This was no downtown. I parked in front of a barber shop and went in to ask the way to Bakersfield College. The friendly, a universal job trait, barber, asked my name and then asked me if I was related to Joe the Jackrabbit Hernandez, who was a speedy wide receiver on the recent national champion Renegade football team. Sorry to disappoint him, I said no and went on my way, having learned a few things from this East Bakersfield encounter. One salient point impressed me. Bakersfield College seemed well known in the community, which then numbered about 60,000. Not, it appeared, as an institution of higher learning, rather as a perennial football power. Indeed, the first January after I began teaching, a multitude of cars and fans swarmed south on Highway 99 to the Rose Bowl to watch BC play for the national championship. The town was proud of its football team, putting 19,000 to 20,000 in the stadium, which then dominated the campus landscape, for games against JC superpowers like Santa Monica City College, which was legendary for its exciting, pass-happy football and huge marching band and flag girl entourage that put on stupefying halftime shows. Maybe, just maybe, I was related to the Jackrabbit after all. In Detroit, my birth city, I never read or heard about another Hernandez. There were only 10 in the phone book. I knew one Lopez, Louis, who played football with me for the McKenzie High Stags. I lived in a neighborhood and city where the largest ethnic group had last names ending with ski. Detroit was a melting pot where all minorities aspired to look and sound like gross pointers, to out-wasp those wasps, which I assume I applied all my pluck to doing. But here I was in Bakersfield, where being a Hernandez was an identity. I think many of my Hispanic students can't figure that part of me out. The students I get to know are always curious about my provenance, because I don't look and sound like people they know. After I tell them about Detroit and my Scotch side, they usually understand my tea and tamales background as well as they can without comparable experience. A Bank of America teller once looked at my driver's license and then at me and demurred, "You're not a Hernandez." This was one of my quicker days as I replied, "I'm a Detroit Hernandez." Stumped, she gave me my money. Even Anglo students are puzzled. One recently told me she thought I was an England Hernandez. That day, in the East Bakersfield barbershop, the question about Joe Hernandez began to make me more aware of my name and Mexican part of me, although I still come off as a Grosse Pointe Ivy League wannabe. Was BC a football power only? Emphatically not. As I approached the campus from Haley Street, its spacious lawns, walks, and buildings — the massive stadium did dominate the landscape then, though — reassured me that it was a real college of a kind not yet built in Michigan. That day, after parking in the visitor's lot and going through the glass doors to the administration building for the first time, I encountered the then new plaque inscribed with, "Only the educated are free." More, I met Peg Levinson, the Dean of Instruction, one of the most articulate, sophisticated, caring people I have known. After welcoming and putting me at ease, she told me to go to the Bakersfield Inn for a good meal. Steak and candlelight, as it turned out. Just a few minutes with her told me I had come to the right place for the beginning of my fledgling teaching life, my professional journey. A place that, as it has turned out, values ideas, prizes education, and the mind. Faculty colleagues I met in the days shortly after confirmed that first impression. I was 24, a kid. How did I get to Bakersfield College? And did the way I got here, to community college teaching, have any bearing on my new trek? Filled with luck, misfortune, lost chances, breaks, and some good intentions, our travels to here unavoidably influence what we do here. Some, like my college roommate, Jim Ryan, seem destined in a clear direction from birth. Jim's father, a physician, died when Jim was very young. Raised by his mother, a nurse, he knew from the time he was self-conscious that he would be a doctor. He was like rooming with a runway, straight and sure. I, on the other hand, have been stops, starts, zigzags, even 360-degree turns. I suspect the stories of most of my colleagues are fractured lines like mine, typical more of the human comedy than an unerring, fated trajectory. The only reason I decided to go to college in the first place was because I wanted to be a minister, and to be one meant getting what we now call post-secondary education. My parents had not gone to college, and while they greatly supported my decision, they would have been happy had I gone to work right after high school, even in the factory, which was honorable work. while many of my high school classmates were college-bound, I don't think that mattered to me. And whereas most of them had a multitude of voices from their homes urging them to become doctors, lawyers, business executives, teachers, etc., I had none except my deep conviction that I was called to be a minister. Called. To be called. To be called out. A quaint concept, but for me, real. What I had to do, to be. I can't pinpoint the exact time or circumstances when I first felt the call. Since I had been preaching, even coming in second in an all-Detroit contest for up-and-coming boy preachers, it must have been during this time, mainly my junior and senior years in high school. Called. Slick boy preacher called to labor in the vineyards of the Lord. I had no doubt, no doubt at all. Thus, spiritually fortified, I was off to college. But which one? Clearly, it couldn't be a worldly place like the University of Michigan, where all manner of sinning, like kissing, seeing movies, and reading books like The Grapes of Wrath, were mixed in a combustible witch's brew. A place where adolescent lust waves filled the spring air? Nope, no chance. For I would be corrupted there, and assuredly lose my virginity and calling. Where then? At first, I was bound for Bob Jones University in Greenville, North Carolina, which closely supervised hand-holding and stamped out lust swiftly and thoroughly. Had I gone there, I might now be dressed in a blue polyester blazer, preaching weekly on the Trinity Broadcasting Network, backdropped by a kitschy set with sparkling heavens, hawking my sermons and inspirational books, win with him, on my divine website, and married to a buxom woman, face larded with wrinkle cream and slashed with mascara and bold red lipstick, topped with an angelic cloud of pink-blue hair. Alas, all this was not to be mine. Mercifully, fortune intervened to save me from that fate. Fortune in the person of an alumnus from Wheaton College in Wheaton, Illinois, active in the Joy Road Baptist Church, who encouraged me to go to his alma mater. Additionally, the trumpet player, song leader of my boy evangelistic team and high school chum, Don Krellen, was going to Wheaton. So Wheaton it was, although I got a nasty note from Bob Jones U when I informed them of my change of heart. Determined to fulfill my calling, I arrived at Wheaton after graduation in January 1955. No Bob Jones, Wheaton was nonetheless a small, intensely religious college with daily compulsory chapel and occasional evangelistic crusades to revive our flagging faith. With a student body of only 1,500, the atmosphere pressured us to be righteous, to stay on the heavenly high road. We all pledged not to smoke, drink, dance, or go to movies. I'm sure the list was longer, maybe 10 commandments. Yet Wheaton had high academic standards and expected its students to excel in rigorous college studies. That was another piece of fortune, because as a theology major, I studied philosophy in a very good department. My ethics professor had a calm, intelligent demeanor and noticeably nicotine-stained fingers, I noted with some interest. So good that I began to find Wheaton intellectually confining. Not only was my mind opened and stretched by Western philosophy, my concept of Christianity was broadened by professors like Kenneth Kanzer, who taught Kierkegaard, Emil Brunner, and Karl Barth, religious existentialists. My synapses were growing apace, and soon Wheaton could no longer feed me what I wanted and needed. Ideas now mattered as much as faith, maybe more. Fall, 1957. From the family-like intimacy of Wheaton, I found myself in Ann Arbor, at the University of Michigan, with its sprawling campus and 20,000 students. I remember one of my first nights there before classes began when I wandered into a large, brightly lit paperback bookstore where, as at a wondrous bazaar, I was entranced and amazed at all the literature, history, and philosophy books arrayed on ranks and ranks of racks at prices so low as to now seem antediluvian. I knew I had found my intellectual home, my intellectual heaven. Even before I left Wheaton, literature began to interest me. At Michigan, while I continued to study philosophy, I changed majors, and literature opened its arms wide to me. The rich variety and fullness of life portrayed in literature complemented the abstract ideas about life analyzed in philosophy. Yet this double major of mine held more. While I was sailing from the narrowness of my religious beliefs, my spirituality was invigorated by literature with its concern for human ambiguity, travail, good, and evil. My calling, as I now see it, was not to a specific religion, but to a concern for humans in their passions and struggles to make sense of existence. I could have majored, after all, in other subjects not related to the humanities, say business or science, but I didn't because the road seemed more naturally to lead to literature and philosophy. I don't mean to imply that those in other majors and who do work other than teaching are not concerned about advancing human good. Obviously they are. Nor do I mean to imply that all who major in philosophy and literature are so concerned. Obviously they aren't. It just seems that given my desire to help others as a minister, my search for transcendence through religion, and my love of both abstract ideas and the English language, made philosophy and literature a more congenial transition as I traveled from a religious calling and vocation to one not religious. Did I accept the offer to teach at Bakersfield College from a clear sense of being called to do so? Was I doing a kind of pilgrim's progress to Bakersfield? Not really. I had run out of money, was tired of graduate school, decided not to go to law school because I had no financial support, and had National Defense Act loans to repay, and just plain needed to get a job. Awareness of teaching as a calling, as a continuation of my earlier journey, came gradually and later. Yet the connection between the two halves of my journey was certainly there. As a minister, I would have served and led a congregation, attempting to guide them to the truth, to find the more to life that is spiritual. I would be a preacher, yes, but also a teacher. After I decided not to be a minister, a decision that took painful years to conclude, I bored my friends talking about it relentlessly and repetitiously. I decided to interview for teaching jobs. One interview was with Bill Priest. Fate, in the form of a pun, the president of American River College, who, noting my background, told me about hiring a minister to teach philosophy. It turned out that the minister's concept of teaching was converting students to his faith. I could see Priest sizing me up, and I never expected to hear from him. I did, though, and would have accepted his offer had I not just signed a contract to teach at BC. Fortune again? I understand the minister confusing his roles, because teaching is in its own way exhorting, nurturing, showing the way. Only the way and the truth are ultimately for our students to determine for themselves. So when I came to Bakersfield that August day in 1961, I'm sure a part of me knew I would be able to fulfill my calling in the classroom among students, those successive, semester-long, always fascinating, sometimes frustrating congregations. Called. Socrates was called. Called to be a gadfly, an inciter to truth. Socrates also saw his calling as a mission for the gods. That's right, for the gods. Too often this aspect of his life and work is ignored, overlooked, or downplayed, perhaps as a source of embarrassment for teachers. But I don't think that the full fervor of his mission can be understood apart from this source of his unrelenting drive. Not that he wanted to convert people to a set of specific beliefs, to make them insufferably dogmatic. On the contrary, knowing that we possess few truths with any certainty, he regarded his calling as one to convert people to doubt and the search for truths central to their lives. He embraced uncertainty and rejected arrogant certainty. He had a calling he could not deny, and I believe laboring in the vineyard of education is also, at its highest, a calling. At last, the journey of this chapter has reached its destination. The conception of teaching is a calling, a vocation, not simply a job. To be called to do something is to feel pressure from within and without. The without can be explicit, as when it issues from religion or society. Uncle Sam needs you. Ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. The implicit call is unvoiced, but unmistakable, powerful, and everywhere. The search for truth and aid to humans in their search. Pressure within is our sense that we can do nothing else but respond to the call. It is our fate. A call, however, does not guarantee good. Evil has its own call, and those who hearken to it often wreak great destruction on humanity. At its best, teaching is a call to help others enlarge that flame of consciousness, knowledge, and wisdom within them. Only the educated have been freed from the dark cave of ignorance, and teachers show them the way out, the way to the distant light, insofar as humans can attain it. People in other vocations are also called to serve others, but since I'm a teacher, it's the only calling I can speak about with the assurance of experience. Is teaching a job? Of course it is. It has its concerns with wages and working conditions, deadlines and responsibilities, committees and paperwork. The mundane and mission are inextricably entwined. But jobs are not callings. They do not engage our highest being, nor do they succor us and raise us to the highest level of commitment. A calling makes us travel beyond the mundane. A calling is not merely a part of our lives, a means to an end. In a profound sense, it is our life. Without it, we are an empty husk. Of course, for some, teaching is only a job. For the best, though, it is a calling. It is their life. Over 40 years ago, I came to Bakersfield College. Over these years, I have taught many courses and many students. Over these years, I have been disappointed by classes and elated by them. Over these years, I have been burdened with exams and papers, frustrated by the unmoved and unmotivated, angered by college politics and wage issues, bored by paperwork and feckless meetings. But through it all, my sense of calling has grown stronger, fed by student successes and by my many colleagues who have inspired me with their devotion to education, to their calling.
Searching for the philosopher's stone.
That was David Otero reading a memoir by Jack Hernandez entitled Called, which refers to his desire as a youth to be called to become a minister. With a name like Hernandez, you might expect that he was born in California. Not so. He actually grew up in Detroit, where he never even heard or read about another Hernandez and knew only one Lopez. As a youngster, inasmuch as he had numerous deep religious convictions, Jack wanted to become a minister. He enrolled at Wheaton College in Illinois and later transferred to the University of Michigan at Ann Arbor. After graduating in 1961, he accepted a job at Bakersfield College. But, he tells us, you can also get a call to teach students in order to see them do well. And now I'm quoting, "My sense of calling has grown stronger, fed by student successes and by my many colleagues who have inspired me with their devotion to education, to their calling." Friends, Jack Hernandez is an emeritus professor of philosophy and the director of the Norman Levin Center for the Humanities at Bakersfield College. He has published a book entitled Walking with Socrates, Reflections on Teaching in a Public Community College. We thank him for his contribution tonight and hope he'll send us more of his work in years to come. And now for our second story. The author is Oscar G. Williams, and he entitles his story, Scamming. Here now is Lee Murray reading, Scamming, by Oscar G. Williams.
Scamming. The special phone rang. Mildred prepared to go into her granny act. She picked up the receiver.
"Hello,"
she hesitantly said. A youthful male voice responded on the other end. "Hello, my name is John Marks. Is this Mrs. Appleby?" Mildred responded,
"Yes, it is, Sonny. Do I know you?"
John said, "Hearing your voice makes me think I have known you for a long time. You sound just like my dear mother." Mildred said,
"That is so sweet, Sonny. Sonny, could you wait a minute? I have to get my hearing piece."
Mildred put the phone on hold and turned to Fred.
"Fred, we have a fish on the line."
Fred said, "Yeah, I picked him up right away. The computer has him. He's calling our number in San Francisco from the Bahamas. Do your thing. By the way, who are you on this call?" Mildred said, "The obituary I ran in the San Francisco paper says I'm Helen Appleby, the widow of a well-to-do developer."
"Okay," Fred chuckled. "Reel him in."
Mildred took John off of hold.
"Sonny, are you still there?"
"Yes, ma'am," said John.
"Mrs. Appleby, that sounds so formal. Do you mind if I call you Helen?" Mildred said,
"Of course you can, dear. You sound so much like my long-lost son, Raymond."
John said, "I'm so sorry to hear you lost your son. Maybe what I have to tell you will lessen the pain. The reason I called you is because you are a very lucky person. Your name was chosen at random for the Bellevue Lottery, and Helen, you are the big winner." Mildred hesitated for an appropriate amount of time and asked,
"You said I won the lottery?"
John said, "Yes, Helen, you won the lottery. The lottery is held in England, and few Americans get the chance to win. I don't know how, but your name got into the system, and you are the big winner." Mildred said,
"You are so kind to call me and let me know about this. I wouldn't have known I was a winner if you hadn't gone out of your way to call me. Thank you so much, Sonny."
John went on, "I want to see that you get the money. We're talking about $200,000. Mildred exaggerated her intake of breath.
She said, "This is too good to be true. I have never won anything before."
John said, "Now, Helen, in order to get the money to you, I'm going to need your help. You are going to have to pay the transfer fee before I can have the lottery winnings transferred to you. Mildred asked,
How do I do that?
John asked, Do you have a bank account?
Yes, I do, said Mildred. It's at the First County Trust.
John said, Good. Here is what we'll do. Give me your account number, the phone number, and address of your bank. I will arrange to have the money transferred into your account as soon as I pay the transfer fee. Mildred asked,
How much is the transfer fee?
John said, It is only $1,500. It will be back in your account with the winnings before you can say jackrabbit. I am so excited for you. Mildred said,
Thank you, Sonny. I'll be right back. Now, don't you hang up.
I wouldn't think of leaving you, said John. Mildred put John on hold and turned to Fred.
Oh, doesn't he sound like a nice boy?
They both laughed. Fred handed Mildred a sheet of paper. Mildred studied it before bringing John back on the line.
Hello, Sonny.
I'm right here, Helen. Do you have the information? Mildred said,
I think so. It's the last bank statement I could find. My late husband used to take care of all the finance matters.
John said, Helen, I am so sorry to hear you lost your husband. Mildred said,
Yes, he passed away a week ago.
John said, Oh, I hope he didn't suffer.
Mildred said, No, he passed away in his sleep.
Fred put his hand over his mouth to keep from laughing out loud. John said, That's good, dear. I'm sure he is up there smiling down on you now that you are a big lottery winner. Mildred said,
I wish he was here to share this.
John said, He will share it through you. Do you have the account information? Mildred read everything on the statement to John, including the electronic transaction numbers. John had her read everything a second time to verify the information. After he had verified the information, he said, Helen, dear, don't you worry about a thing. I'm going to have the transfer made to your account by tomorrow morning. When you wake up, you are going to be rich. Mildred said,
Thank you so much, Sonny. I'll always remember you. Could you call me sometime? I don't have a lot of friends.
I sure will, John said. I won't be a stranger just because you are rich. Goodbye for now. John hung up. Mildred hung up. Mildred turned to Fred. Is it all set up? Fred said, I'm just waiting for the suckers to access your phony account. As soon as they do, I'll destroy the number that John Person called you on. Fred and Mildred sat intently watching the computer screen. Fred yelled with excitement. There they go! They're starting the transaction! In a dirty warehouse, someplace in the Bahamas, filled with people on telephones, a man sat at a computer transferring funds from Helen's account into the scammer's account. His sodden expression turned to shock. He rebooted his suddenly dead computer and accessed his account. He took one look, jumped up from his chair, and yelled for his boss. His boss came running from a corner in the warehouse. He shouted to the computer operator to lower his voice before he disrupted the other scammers tucked in their little cubicles. When the boss arrived at the computer, the operator told him something had gone wrong with the last transaction. The boss asked, What happened? The operator said, After I made the transfer of funds from the Appleby account, there was a lot of gibberish on the screen, and then a message said, Thanks. Goodbye, sucker. And the computer shut down. I rebooted and called up our account. It's empty. The boss asked, How much did you get from the Appleby account?
The operator said there was $3,472.23. I took it all. The boss asked, how much was in our account? We had about $150,000. And now you tell me we have what? The boss screamed. None, the operator said. It's empty. Someone took all of our money. The boss said, get it back, you big dummy. The operator said, I can't. I don't know where it went. The boss asked, are you trying to pull some kind of crap on me? Money doesn't just up and disappear. The operator said, I wouldn't do that, boss. You know I wouldn't. The boss looked the operator in the eye and said, if you don't get that money back, someone will pay. Mildred asked Fred, how much did we get this time? Just a little over $150,000, Fred answered. That brings our take this month to a little under $300,000. Fred, I still think you should patent your system. Mildred, I am 72 years old. I already have more patents than I can remember. They bring in more royalties than we could spend in 10 lifetimes. Don't forget the key point. If I patent my system of encrypting operating instructions into all types of data transmissions between computers, someone will finally realize who has been using the system to clean out the scammers over the last year. You wouldn't want to meet any of the people whom we've cleaned out, would you? Mildred said, no, I don't think so. Fred had created his former company from scratch. The company name was Fred Busters. His company specialized in developing anti-hacking systems for everything from the personal computer to the top secret computers in the Pentagon, the CIA, and the FBI. He had a few patents in his name, but most of them were under the company's name. He sold his company for $2 billion. The new owners named the company Security Plus. Mildred was a world-renowned actress. She had appeared on the stage throughout the world in movies and had appeared in a number of programs on television. Mildred and Fred considered themselves retirees. They had developed an interesting hobby which drew upon both of their talents. Fred and Mildred now call themselves Scam Busters. They didn't advertise this assumed title because it was their private joke. Fred's special talents was in developing anti-hacking systems. In order to develop those systems, he had to be a master hacker. Mildred's talent as an actress completed the prolific duo of Scam Busters. It sometimes takes a thief to catch a thief. Fred and Mildred donated all of the ill-gotten scammers' money they took to various charities under anonymous names. Fred asked, where is our next area of fun and games? Mildred said, I picked Denver for our next move. Next week, I'm going to run an obituary of a prominent investor who left a widow named, how about Josephine? I've always liked that name, said Fred. Mildred jokingly asked, is there someone in your past I should know about? You know better than that. We've been married for over 50 years. Okay, said Mildred. In the next scam, I'm going to be Josephine. Fred said, I'll start setting up the phony phone numbers and bank accounts in the Denver area. When the scammer sees your advertisement, Josephine, will be in business. A bunch of disgruntled men sat around a table in a smoke-filled room. One of them said, we've got a big problem here. The reason I called you guys is because we've got a mutual problem. Some sucker has been ripping us off. Every one of us has been hit by this guy. A burly guy at the other end of the table said, whoever he is good. I've had my people trying to track him down for months, and they haven't gotten to first base. Someone else spoke up. Yeah, my people ran into the same dead end. They say the techniques he is using to scam us haven't been invented yet. The first speaker said, well, they are wrong. We have got to get this guy, or we are out of business. We're going to have to pool our resources and hire the best computer people in the world to stop this guy. The group sent their henchmen throughout the world to search for the best company they could find to lead them to the hacker. They hired the best computer people they could find. They hired Fred's former company, Security Plus. the motley, disgruntled group held another meeting. This time, the spokesman said, "We gotta get this guy. I told those computer folks to find him no matter how much it cost. When they find him, he is going to wish he was never born." The group nodded their heads in agreement. Fred's former employees had no idea Fred was the hacker they were up against. They first tried every technique they had ever developed to try and find the hacker. When they failed to find him, they developed new exotic techniques, but to no end, because Fred continued to take over their clients' accounts. Mildred was on the line working a fish when she heard Fred mumble something in the background. Mildred said, "Would you hold on, Sonny? I have to get something." The fish said, "I'll be right here when you get back." Mildred put her hand over the phone and turned to Fred. "Fred, what's going on?" Fred said, "You won't believe this. My old company is trying to find us. I recognize some of their search signals. I thought I recognized some of my handiwork, and now I am sure of it." Mildred asked, "Can they find us? Shall I hang up?" Fred said, "No, they can't trace the signal to us. Right now they are trying to follow the signal of the phone you are on. They have been trying everything to keep me out of their systems. I anticipated they would try some kind of new electronic tracking. I've been waiting for this. I'm going to let them track my signal right to its source." Mildred said, "But you said they couldn't find us." Fred said, "They can't. But they think they can, because I'm letting them follow a signal they think is mine. They are in for a surprise." Mildred asked, "Shall I continue with the fish?" Fred said, "Yeah, we don't have a problem. Work him for a while in order to give them plenty of time to get a lock on the signal they are following. I'll give you the high sign when you can let the fish go." Mildred took her hand off the phone and said, "Are you still there, Sonny?" The disgruntled, motley, unshaven group sat in the smoke-filled room again. They were digesting the information the computer people had given them. The computer people had tracked the signal of the guy who'd been ripping them off. Each time they traced the signal, they ended up in the same place. They traced the signal to Washington, D.C. The signal was coming from the White House. The motley group sat there looking at one another in disbelief. Finally, one of them said, "The government is ripping us off. This is illegal." The spokesman looked at the speaker and said in disgust, "I guess you think what we're doing is legal. Can't you see what they're doing? They can't touch us legally here in the Bahamas, so they've set up some kind of group like the Watergate folks to get at us." Someone else in the group said, "How can we fight the government?" The leader of the group said, "We can't fight the government, but we could leak it to the press that some kind of illegal group like the Watergate folks are operating out of the White House. That could shut them down." The newspapers ate it up. The White House denied it. Congress demanded a hearing. The mob in the Bahamas were happy because the intruder had not hit them, since the newspapers said the White House was running some kind of covert operation in the Bahamas. Everyone in the mob was happy until one day, one of the underlings in the dirty warehouse burst into the boss's office. He yelled, "Boss, he's back! The hacker is back! I talked to our computer company, and you won't believe what they said. They told me that they tracked his signals to the Kremlin in Moscow. He's in Russia! Russia and the United States are working against us!" Mildred and Fred sat on their patio sipping tea. Fred asked Mildred, "Where do you think I should send the mob this time?" She thought for a moment and said, "Send them to the Chinese capital." They laughed, sipped their tea, and watched the beautiful sunset.
That was Lee Murray reading Oscar G. Williams' story, Scamming. In it, he tells us about Fred, a computer wizard, and Mildred, a fine actress, who have teamed up to scam the scammers. First, they would put an ad in the obituary section of a big city newspaper announcing that a fictitious man had passed away, leaving his widow a lot of money. That really whets the appetite of the scammers, and before you know it, they call the supposed widow. That's where Mildred comes in, because she can put on an act as though she were the grieving widow and pretend to be absolutely jubilant when the scammers tell her that she just won a fabulous amount of money in a lottery somewhere. The scammers then ask for a transfer fee so they can put all the winnings from the lottery into her bank account, and she acts as though she's absolutely going to do whatever they tell her, at which point Fred, with his unbelievable computer skills, has a way of emptying all the scammers' bank accounts. The story ends as the scammers try to figure out who's scamming them. Thanks so much for an amusing story, Oscar Williams. We all got a good laugh listening to it. But I think I'd be remiss if I didn't remind all of our listeners that scamming is indeed a huge problem nowadays. And for all of you within the sound of my voice to be aware of phone calls, letters, emails, or social media messages which tell you that you've won a lot of money in a lottery that you never even entered. Friends, besides having written two books, A Token's View from Inside the IRS and Flying High, Oscar G. Williams has written numerous columns for the Fresno Bee. We certainly thank him for that enjoyable story tonight and invite him to send us more of his work in seasons to come. And so we come to the end of another edition of Valley Writers Read. Thank you for listening. If you'd like to listen to tonight's or any other Valley Writers Read story again, just go online at kvpr.org and click on to Valley Writers Read. Next week, our author will be Bonnie Hearn Hill. In the meantime, this is your host, Franz Weinschenk, wishing you and yours a great life story until we meet again. Good night.
Valley Writers Read is a production of Valley Public Radio, produced by Don Weaver and Franz Weinschenk. Please join us again next Wednesday at 7 p.m. for another edition of Valley Writers Read.